Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. My name is Shaylin Belka, and I'm a Senior Health Promotion Specialist here at PTCC, and I will be moderating today's webinar, Ontario's New Tobacco Control Measures, Accomplishments, Snares, and Snags. If you're having trouble logging into the webinar, please call the 1-800 number for PTCC. This help number is 1-800-363-7822. And for those of you who are logged into the webinar, you will see the presentation on your right. On the left-hand side of the screen, you will see a chat box. We have set aside two time periods for questions during and after the presentation, but at any time during the presentation, please feel free to enter your questions into the chat box, and we will address them when we can. We may not be able to answer the questions in order, but we'll do our best to answer them at the most appropriate time. Please also note that during today's webinar, the phone lines have been muted to minimize background noise. Before we begin, we'd like to get a better sense of how many of you are on the phone today. Please indicate how many people are attending today's webinar with you by simply clicking the circle beside the appropriate number. We'll just give you 1 minute to fill this out. Thanks very much, everyone. I'd now like to introduce you to our presenters. Dr. Rob Schwartz is the Executive Director of the Ontario Tobacco Research Unit and Associate Professor at the Dalhousie School of Public Health, University of Toronto, with interest in research, evaluation, and knowledge exchange. Dr. Michael Chayton is a scientist at OTRU and Assistant Professor at the Dalhousie School of Public Health. Michael's main areas of research include smoking cessation, smoking comorbidities, and understanding the impact of widespread retail availability on tobacco. And Jolene Dubray is the research officer at OTRU, where she coordinates evaluation research related to implementation and enforcement of smoke-free policies, supports OTRU's knowledge and evaluation service requests, and contributes to the writing of OTRU's strategy monitoring report. Take it away, Rob, Michael, and Jolene.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for joining us today. It's a pleasure to be back. It was a nice summer where we had no webinars, but I hope that we all had some relaxation and some time in the sun with sunscreen on. I do want to say that the picture that is on that slide of me is 10 years old now, so it doesn't depict a true understanding of who I am at this point in time. In any case, we'll try and update that for the next time round. We're delighted to be talking about Ontario's new tobacco control measures. It is an exciting time for tobacco control in Ontario and in Canada as a whole, but Ontario has moved forward on several quite important measures. And to see how important they are and to learn about their implementation and their actual impact on achieving the desired outcome of decreased tobacco use prevalence, we're going to show you what we're doing. You know, it's our job as the Ontario Tobacco Research Unit. Part of our mandate is to evaluate the Smoke-Free Ontario strategy. And as part of that, obviously, evaluating the effect of the new measures is part and parcel. We're doing our utmost with some constraints, and we're going to tell you a little bit about what we're doing, what we've done to date, and some of our findings. So, here we go. This is a graphic depiction of some of the main new measures that are included in the Making Ontario's Healthy, Making, how do we say it? The Making Healthier Choices Act, Making Healthier Choices Act, and the E-Cigarette Act. And some of these new measures also were included in previous amendments to the existing Smoke-Free Ontario Act. So excitingly, Ontario has moved forward with banning the smoking of tobacco products in some outdoor places, with banning the use of flavor, with some exceptions in all tobacco products. Is moving forward with banning menthol cigarettes, has instituted e-cigarette controls, and we're going to talk more in detail about each of these. Not all of the e-cigarette measures are actually in place right now, but the one on restricting access to minors is already in place. The other two are restricting promotion at point of sale, and then restricting vaping of e-cigarettes in places where cigarette smoking is not allowed. And those latter two, we're hoping we're going to see put into place very soon. The other two that we have are improved retail control. This includes increasing fines for the sale of cigarettes to minors. Then we also have hospital campus restrictions, meaning that on hospital campuses, meaning outdoors in hospitals, on hospital grounds, as of today, smoking is only allowed in designated smoking areas. And as of 2018, I believe my resident expert is whispering in my ear here, as of 2018, no smoking at all will be allowed on hospital grounds. So put together, this is a very exciting package. Let's move forward to see what it is that we're doing to help evaluate these different things. So the outdoor smoking bans came in already in 2015, and we have conducted street intercept interviews as well as key informant interviews to learn what has been their effect to date. Jolene is going to tell you about the results of that work very shortly. The e-cigarette measures, the three of them that we talked about. So we have RECIG, which is our research on electronic cigarettes, which was funded by the Health System Research Fund at the Ministry of Health. And that provides us with a very good baseline of the use of e-cigarettes and their patterns of use in Ontario. And we've spoken about that at a previous webinar, which you can find on a podcast. In addition to that, we will be looking at enforcement data, which is going to be looking at the sale of e-cigarettes to minors at this point in time. We have already conducted through the health unit street intercept interviews, which are teaching us something about the use of e-cigarettes and the attitudes about the new e-cigarettes legislation amongst the general population. The Flavor Gone, which is a fantastic accomplishment, we're going to be analyzing sales data to see what changes have happened. You know, what happens when people who've been using flavored tobacco are no longer able to purchase flavored tobacco? This applies to smokeless tobacco, to chew, to cigarillos, to cigars, to pipes, to hookah tobacco. So what are these people doing? Are they quitting smoking or use of tobacco altogether? Are they moving to different products? Are they moving to e-cigarettes, for example? So we're going to look at sales data. We're going to actually do a purchase study. We are going to look at enforcement data. And we are conducting some interviews with youth. On the stipulations to improve retail control, we are going to be looking at enforcement data and conducting key informant interviews. On the menthol ban, we have, in addition to a purchase study and to the analysis of sales data, we are going to be doing a survey of smokers. So we're going to talk a little bit more about this later on, but we are going to be recruiting about 1,000 menthol smokers and following them up to see what happens with them post-ban. The ban on menthol cigarettes is due to come into effect on January 1st, 2017. And then finally, on the hospital campus restrictions, we'll be looking at enforcement data and also conducting some key informant interviews. So those are the main the sources of evaluative information that we will be drawing upon as we evaluate the new measures. Here's your first polling question. Really interested in your perceptions about this. So which new measure do you think will have the greatest impact on decreasing the prevalence of tobacco use in Ontario? Outdoor smoking bans, e-cigarette controls, flavor gone, improved retail control, the menthol ban, that's menthol cigarette ban, or hospital campus restrictions? Please choose one of these and answer the poll. Okay, so they're about to tally up, interestingly, we see that most of these are getting, fairly even results across several of them. We now have 84 responses, and we will read you the results, because I understand that some but not all of you may be able to see the results on your screen. And if I proceed to the next slide, go back to the previous slide. Oh, there we go. Thank you. And here's a graphic display of the results. And the winner is improved retail control. That's 30% of you thought that was going to have the greatest impact. And that is followed by flavor gone at 21%, the menthol ban at 14%. I've missed the outdoor smoking ban. That was 25%. So the first is retail control. The second is the outdoor smoking ban. Then flavor gone at 21%, menthol ban at 14%, e-cigarette controls 7%, and hospital campus restrictions at 2.4%. So this is a really interesting result, actually unanticipated. The correct answer is, I don't know. And that's actually why we're doing our evaluative work. We are going to try and figure this out. I could say your guess is as good as mine. I will say that I am surprised by the very large proportion of you who indicated improved retail control would have the greatest impact. And it might be interesting to see in discussion or in question period why people think that is. It's not one I would have chosen. Again, I don't know the answer, and maybe you're right. We will find out as we move forward. So keep these results in mind as we move forward through the presentation, and I think they will help inform some discussion moving on. And now Jolene is going to talk about the findings from our first wave of the evaluation in 2015-16.
Thanks, Rob. So last year, OUTRA conducted an evaluation to assess the implementation of the new outdoor smoking regulations and the impact of the regulations on smoking behavior and exposure to secondhand smoke. We did this through street intercept surveys, key informant interviews, and an online enforcement staff survey. So first I'll present the results from the street intercept surveys. These were conducted in June to October last year, and four health units took part in it, Algoma, Lambton, Toronto, and Windsor Essex. Just over 1,300 survey respondents completed the survey. 46% were smokers. Questions on the survey included smoking behavior at affected venues, exposure to secondhand smoke, awareness of outdoor smoking regulations, and the impact of outdoor smoking regulations. So this graph depicts the self-reported smoking behavior at regulated venues. Questions were asked twice, once for the interview time period, which is represented by the yellow 2015 data points, and once for the time period a year before the survey, represented by the 2014 purple data points. So in 2015, up to 70% of smokers reported that they smoked at least sometimes when visiting venues affected by smoking bans. But despite these high levels, smokers reported smoking less frequently at affected venues in 2015 compared to a year before the survey. The greatest drop in self-reported smoking was on restaurant and bar patios, from 83% in 2014 down to 47% in 2015. So So polling question number two, which outdoor venue had the highest level of self-reported exposure to secondhand smoke in 2015? Do you think it was in playgrounds, sports fields, restaurant and bar patios, or park festivals and fairs? Look at the results. It seemed that the majority of you said park festivals and fairs at 48%, followed closely behind by restaurant and bar patios at 38%. 10% of you said sports fields, and almost 3% of you said playgrounds. So let's find out what the answer is. It's park festivals and fairs. So congratulations, that was the majority of you got that right. So again, similar to the smoking behavior, questions were asked twice, once for the interview time period, which is represented by the yellow 2015 data points, and once for the time period before the survey, so those are represented by the purple 2014 data points. In 2015, substantial levels of self-reported exposure to secondhand smoke were reported, ranging from 37% at playgrounds up to 81% at park festivals or fairs. Yet, self-reported exposure again to secondhand smoke at all affected venues decreased in 2015 compared to a year before the survey. The greatest drop in self-reported exposure was at restaurant and bar patios, again, from 85% in 2014 down to 57% in 2015. Survey questions in our 2015 survey didn't distinguish if the smoke was coming from the regulated area or outside the regulated area. We changed that in the survey that we just did this summer. So we asked a question of where the smoke was drifting from. And preliminary results from that survey suggest that the majority of the drifting smoke from playgrounds and patios was coming from areas outside the regulated area, so this is again 2016 data, whereas drifting smoke at sports fields appeared to come equally from both the regulated area and from outside the regulated area. In terms of public awareness, two-thirds of survey respondents were aware of the ban on smoking on restaurant and bar patios, while just over half of the survey respondents were aware of the ban on smoking on and around sports fields and playgrounds. For the impact of smoking regulations on quitting behavior, 42% of smokers believe that the new smoking regulations would help them quit or cut down the number of cigarettes they smoked. Next, I'll present the results from our enforcement staff survey. The online survey was sent out to 131 TEOs in the province. It was conducted in November 2015, which was about 11 months after the implementation of the new regulations. 64 survey respondents completed the survey, which is about a 49% response rate, and we got responses from 30 out of 36 public health units. Questions on this survey included questions on compliance, active enforcement, challenges in implementation, and successes. Enforcement staff perceived compliance to be strongest at restaurant and bar patios at 89%, followed by playgrounds where 71% felt the compliance was strong, and last, sports fields, 55% of enforcement staff felt compliance was strong there. In terms of active enforcement, on the far left of the graph, you'll see the number of complaints. Most complaints received were related to smoking in playgrounds. Warnings were issued for smoking on restaurant bar patios in a rate that was double that of sports fields and playgrounds. And very few tickets had been issued at the time of this survey for smoking on the newly regulated outdoor public places. There were 13 tickets issued for smoking on restaurant bar patios. In terms of implementation challenges, half of the TEOs that completed the survey noted the lack of public awareness and pre-existing bylaw had overlapped with the new SFOA regulations were challenges to implementing the new SFOA outdoor regulations. Adequate staffing to proactively enforce the new regulations was a challenge for 30% of the TEOs who completed the survey. And about a quarter of TEOs reported that approaching non-compliant individuals, encountering individuals who are vocal about their lack of support for the new regulations, and having adequate staff to address complaints were also challenges to implementing the new SFOA regulations. 11% of the TEOs reported that they did not experience any challenges when implementing the new outdoor regulations. Of those that said other challenges, some of the other challenges, the text that they wrote in for the survey response that were related to signage, included funding for signage installation, issues with municipalities posting signage, sign pollution, SFOA regulations that conflict with bylaw signage that are already posted. Implementation successes. TEOs reported that the greatest success for in implementing the new SFOA outdoor regulations was the increased awareness among owners and operators of venues affected by the smoking ban, followed closely by the increased awareness among the public over time. And just over half the enforcement staff felt that improved levels of compliance at affected venues demonstrate success in implementing the new SFOA outdoor regulations. Again, some of the other text responses that were written in included collaboration with municipalities, public support for playgrounds, collaboration with food inspectors to distribute information to restaurant and bar owners, development of new municipal policies for special events and fairs in public parks. So last, I'll go over the results from our key informant interviews. Key informants that were interviewed included individuals involved in management, implementation, public education, or enforcement of the Smoke-Free Ontario Act. The interviews were conducted from November of last year to January 2016. In total, we interviewed 10 people representing 6 public health units, and these interviews looked at identifying factors facilitating and or impeding the implementation of the new Smoke-Free Ontario Act smoking regulations. For education, some of the key informants reported that their health unit developed educational materials and organized local outreach campaigns to supplement the province's educational campaign. Local outreach campaigns included media releases, fact sheets, social media promotion, and distributing postcards, placemats, or coasters advertising smoke-free patios. Key informants also reported that they met personally with municipal staff and or visited all or most of the restaurants or bars in their region to educate and deliver signage. These key informants credit the high rates of compliance to this outreach approach. For enforcement, key informants reported that enforcement was largely conducted in response to complaints. Some health units took a more proactive approach to restaurant and bar patios and park festivals and fairs. Education was provided primarily in response to non-compliance, since non-compliance occurred most often due to lack of awareness. Verbal and written warnings were typically given to repeat offenders only. For compliance at playgrounds and sports fields, overall good in compliance with the Smoke-Free Ontario Act regulations overall. However, compliance varied by municipality and type of regulated area. Compliance was high during daytime hours when children were present and decreased in sports fields during evenings when adult recreational leagues played. In terms of compliance at restaurant bar patios, compliance was also differed by across regions. Reoccurring problems with a handful of restaurant or owners was reported, and while it took some time, almost all patios were compliant by the end of the summer, again in 2015. Excuse me. In terms of compliance at park festivals and fairs, compliance wasn't necessarily 100%, and that had to do with the larger space. It's more difficult to enforce, and you'll always get one person who's trying to smoke somewhere in the crowd. Success was due in partnerships with organizers, particularly increased confidence that the organizers would address smoking if smoking was observed during the event, and the display of banners advertising smoke-free places. In terms of barriers encountered, municipalities posting signage was one of the main barriers that was reported. Some municipalities had not posted signage. Enforcement staff said it was difficult to enforce a bylaw or a policy, without proper signage posted, and that some health units were reluctant to ticket and fine non-compliant municipalities. Instead, they would prefer that the province take action. Another barrier included capacity and other bylaws that conflicted with the regulations. So in terms of capacity, staffing, and financial constraints limited capacity to actively inspect regulated areas. The new regulations conflicted with pre-existing bylaws in some municipalities. And where bylaws were more strict, they continued to enforce those. But where the bylaws were similar or less strict than the new SFOA regulations, it became cumbersome to replace the signage. In terms of facilitators, success in achieving compliance was mainly attributed to partnerships with vendors, municipality staff, and other organizations such as the Alcohol and Gaming Commission, and mainly in-person education visits. So in conclusion, the new outdoor regulations appear to have had a positive effect on reducing smoking behavior and exposure to secondhand smoke at affected venues. However, the levels of self-reported secondhand smoke exposure are still high, from 37% to 81%. But more work needs to be done to increase public awareness and compliance at sports fields and playgrounds in particular. Partnerships and proactive education contributed to success. Capacity constraints, signage, and pre-existing bylaws were the main challenges, and consideration should be given to these challenges when drafting future amendments.
Thanks very much, Jillian. Thanks very much, Rob. We do have a few questions. I'd like to open up the floor. Please feel free to type any questions that you have right now in the chat box, and we will continue afterwards. We have a few questions here, Jolene. How were the locations for intercept surveys chosen? And then also, how were the public health units and key informants chosen?
So in terms of I'll start with the health units. Last summer, we had a couple other evaluations that were going on through our knowledge and evaluation support services. So those two health units were kind enough to add these questions to their surveys. And then we actively recruited through other partners. That's how we got our four last year. And then
right. It was open to any health unit that wanted to participate. We would have loved to have had more. And these were the four that agreed to come on board.
And in terms of location of the interviews, we asked that they conduct them in the areas that were affected by the regulations, so in playgrounds, in sports fields, at restaurant bar patios, as much as possible. That was the direction that we gave them. And I think internally within the health units, they decided which ones were hot spots where they might be able to get the most people to answer the survey.
Perfect. Thank you. We do have another question here. I'm not sure if you will be able to speak to it, but please feel free. Would you be able to speak to why the volumes of issued tickets seem to be so low in contrast to the complaints made? And I'd also like to welcome anybody on the line. If you have an idea why this might be, to please feel free to type that into the chat box as well, and I can share that.
I guess first I'd have to say that the data for the warnings, complaints, and tickets may not be complete. It's not representative, and it's not complete. 26 health units answered that question. So it may not represent a complete picture of what happened at that time. I'm sure the fact that the volume of tickets is being so low might be, again, that they were only ticketing repeat offenders and that they were probably doing a lot of education leading up to that point before they would, and it's progressive enforcement.
Our experience with the implementation of SFOA is that many health units and enforcement units like at the beginning to focus on education and awareness and warnings perhaps, and only later on to do the ticketing. in our analysis of enforcement data in the coming year, we'll have better data about this, and I would expect that the number of tickets relative to the number of warnings would go up.
Thank you so much. We do have a couple more questions, and please feel free to share your comments as well. We do have a comment here that I'd just like to share because I think it relates to what we were just chatting about. We have a comment here saying, generally, compliance is easy to achieve with outdoor spaces due to the fact that smokers are generally willing to move in order to avoid a fine. So there's one insight into some of the questions that we were having. And we do have a few other questions, and I believe that it more relates to the folks who may be listening to this webinar, but please feel free, again, to share. Do you happen to know, Jolene or Rob, if there are any plans from the public health units that you spoke with to deal with the high reported secondhand smoke exposure at festivals?
I know Lambton, I believe, was doing a campaign this summer. They were focusing on that specifically to try and improve the compliance there. Off the top of my head, that's all I'm aware of.
And I will say just more generally, I was kind of shocked at the very high levels of exposure to secondhand smoke and the very high levels of reported smoking in these venues. And so this, you know, these data have been presented to the Ministry of Health and to the Protection and Enforcement Task Force. The hope would be that the ministry, together with the health units, would deliberate and to see if more could be done to make things better for all of us.
Great. Thanks so much, Rob and Jolene. And now we're going to welcome Michael Chaitin to his portion of the webinar.
Hi there, thank you. So I'm going to be talking about two separate parts to my talk today. The first will be on examining some public support for these new measures, and the second part will be to talk briefly about some of the work that we did in conjunction with Johns Hopkins University to evaluate the implementation of a menthol ban that came into place in Alberta and Nova Scotia, and some of the potential lessons for Ontario. But first, we'll talk a little bit about the public support that we are aware of now. So to assess support, we use the CAMH monitor. And so this particular set of data came from the CAMH monitor that was surveyed in 2015. So this is before data, let's call it. And the CAMH monitor is a population representative cross-sectional survey of adults 18 plus in Ontario. The survey is stratified by region to provide for the ability to do regional analysis, and they do that by telephone calls. And this particular subset of questions was asked to about 1,000 participants for this tobacco policy module. Some of the wording of the questions was more generic than the actual specific implementation questions for these new measures. And that's because we've been asking some of these questions about these different types of policies for many, many years. The CAMH monitor is an annual survey, and we have been tracking population trends. But for today, we'll just talk about the results from 2015. Participants were asked for their support for various tobacco policies. And then by support, we generally asked whether or not they agreed with a particular statement, and whether or not they strongly agreed, somewhat disagree, or strongly disagree. And for this presentation, we collapsed to agree versus disagree. So the first question is, some tobacco products can have different flavors, such as menthol, strawberry, coffee, or wine, and should flavored products be banned? And For these sets of questions, I'm showing both the responses separately by non-smokers and current smokers, because for many of these, of course, it's there are very different results by each of these subpopulations. And so support was generally fairly high for banning flavors by non-smokers and lower for current smokers at 32%. We also asked about banning e-cigarette product flavors. And here the results were actually quite similar between smokers and for non-smokers for cigarettes versus e-cigarettes, at nearly over 60% agreement with this statement. Current smokers were slightly lower, with 20% agreement with the idea of banning flavors for e-cigarette products. In terms of the e-cigarette age ban, the sale of e-cigarettes to youth under 19 years of age should be banned. Non-smokers were strongly in favor of this, with 91% support. And even current smokers were also broadly in favor of this regulation, with 80% support from not current smokers for this, for banning sales under 19 years of age. That support continued for the use of electronic or e-cigarettes in settings currently covered by smoke-free legislation in Ontario, with 90% support from non-smokers, and even close to 60% of support for current smokers of equal legislation in terms of cigarettes and e-cigarettes. In terms of smoke-free spaces, this graph or this slide looks just at the response for non-smokers for their support of banning smoke from different locations. So the strongest support is from near public building entrances. At 93%. I'm sorry. Actually, the strongest support is near outdoor children's playgrounds at 96%. So very universal support about banning smoking from those locations, followed closely by near public building entrances, and then near outdoor recreation facilities or fields at 87%, which is interesting considering the level of exposure still seen in those areas. Next, popular for in terms of restrictions on smoking with outdoor patios, restaurants, and bars, and followed by in public parks and beaches, where support was still extremely high, where close to three-quarters of non-smokers supported restrictions in these spaces. For current smokers, there was much more variation in their support for different restrictions. Again, a near outdoors children's playground was actually very high, with 84% support of banning smoking near children's playgrounds. Near public building entrances, there was also strong support about current smokers, with three-quarters suggesting that it was appropriate to restrict smoking in these areas. This followed by near outdoor recreation facilities and fields, with, again, fairly strong support for this regulation. However, for outdoor patios and in public parks and beaches, there are much less support by current smokers at 37% and 32%, respectively. We also looked at some of these issues, not just by smoking, but by age and other factors. So the one issue which had a relationship with age was actually the support for flavor restrictions, and that older people, both this is lumping together current smokers and non-smokers, were much more likely to support flavor restrictions compared to younger smokers. And this is both in terms of cigarette and e-cigarette flavors. Women were also generally much more likely to support restrictions on a number of these measures, including on cigarette, e-cigarette flavors, bans on smoking on playgrounds, outdoor fields, and parks. There were a few significant differences that we were able to identify by region. The one exception to this was that bans of smoking on outdoor patios was the highest in Toronto compared to other regions. This is the end of our public support information, but we are continuing to survey the Ontario, and we should have more data for 2016 as well. So one of the key features of this new measure act, and one of the very much exciting measures in terms of its novelty both in Canada and internationally, is the ban on menthol cigarettes flavoring in Ontario that will be hopefully implemented in a few months. And I will be talking today about some of the work we've done in evaluating the menthol ban in other jurisdictions, particularly in Alberta and Nova Scotia, which have already started to implement this restriction. This evaluation has been published in the journal Tobacco Control. The lead author is Jennifer Brown, and it was led by Joanna Cohen from the Johns Hopkins University. And this study, the methodology was a sample cigarette purchase in Alberta and pre- and post-ban, and then in Nova Scotia post-ban because because of the timing of the study itself. And so what happened is that research assistants went into stores and asked clerks for menthol and green packs pre-ban, and then after the ban they asked for menthol, menthol replacement, and green packs post-ban. And each of the unique packs were purchased and identified, and then content analysis of the menthol packs and descriptors occurred. I think some of these packs have now been sent for further product analysis in terms of what they actually contained, but this study is related to the descriptors on the pack themselves and the advertising associated with it. The results of the study was, in Alberta, we found that there were 199 different menthol packs purchased from 14 brand families. So a brand family is something like, here in this example, is the brand number 7, or a brand like De Maurier. And these brand families have different descriptors associated with them. So, for instance, De Maurier Smooth, or and these used to be the lights and extra lights that names have been changed. And these brand families come from, they're owned by a number of different companies. So in Alberta, after the implementation of the ban, there were 63 menthol replacement packs that were purchased from 4 brand families owned by just one single parent company. So that is, we didn't find any direct non-compliance with this law. So there was no purchasing of menthol packs that were being sold as menthol after the implementation of the ban. However, there were a number of brands that were meant to replace the product in different kind of ways from the product that existed before the ban. In Nova Scotia, however, there were no menthol replacement packs sold, and there may be different reasons for that. But Nova Scotia may not be as important a market, or they may be waiting for the results of test marketing in Alberta and other places for such implementation. So here's a better example of what these menthol replacement look like. So this is the brand number 7. And this is to the left of this picture is the pre-ban pack of number 7s. And so you can see at the bottom corner there, it says 25 cigarettes menthol. Where if we look at the brand to the right, where it had said menthol in that corner, it now says KS Green, and KS stands for probably king size here. And so the descriptor of menthol has been replaced with the descriptor of green. And this is consistent with some of the work or some of the replacement packs that went on after the ban on descriptors such as light and mild, where the words light were replaced with similar descriptors that were meant to evoke the idea of a cigarette being light without actually using the words. And so these replacement packs are now trying to evoke the idea of menthol without actually saying so on the pack itself. And this was advertised directly to retailers. So this is an advertisement from a convenience store magazine. It suggests that the writing here, to support the launch of these non-menthol alternatives, all SKUs, the units, will come with this message for 8 weeks. And this message is that the new and smooth taste, so it's redesigned without menthol. So it's the idea that retailers and people purchasing the pack are meant to understand that these are a replacement pack for the previous menthol. So that PMI in particular in this case, and maybe other companies will in the future, have repackaged their products post-ban to communicate this idea of menthol-like flavoring using color and substitution descriptors. Again, we don't know whether this extends to any changes in the actual content of the cigarette itself, but more research and monitoring of this menthol ban implementation is very much needed. And with that, we'll back to Rob.
Okay, thank you. And I see that there are some questions and comments coming up. I have just a couple of slides. We'll end it there, and then we'll open it up for discussion, and we'll address some of those. So what I wanted to do is to tell you a little bit about the work that the work that we are doing this year and in the coming years to evaluate the new measures. For the purposes of this work, we have an advisory group, an evaluation advisory group, as we always do. And you can see on the slide that we have several organizations represented. We have two people representing public health units, including people who know quite a lot about enforcement, and we wouldn't do it without them. We have people working at the provincial level, and we have invited the ministry to send a representative as well, and I think that once our funding package is approved, we may see them joining in. Their advice is absolutely necessary, and we are in touch with them in any case. Part of what we're able to do is enabled by a grant that we've received from the National Institutes of Health in the United States, who's very interested in menthol because as much as menthol is a challenge in Ontario and in Canada, it's a much larger one in the United States, and the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration in the United States, is seriously considering a action on menthol in the United States. And so they've funded us to do some more rigorous work, which includes a consumer arm, which is where we're going to we are already at work identifying 1,000 menthol smokers who we are going to talk with on the phone pre-ban, and then we are going to follow them up twice, 1 month after the ban comes into effect and once 11 months later to see what they've done. Where have they gone with their smoking? Are they still smoking cigarettes, et cetera? And then we have an industry arm in which we are able to do a pack purchase similar to the one that Michael just described that was done in Alberta and Nova Scotia. And we will be doing these pre- and post-menthol ban to see what the tobacco companies are coming up for us in Ontario, which is, as we know, a much, much larger market than Alberta or Nova Scotia. So we are going to end with one final polling question. What do you think menthol smokers will do when menthol cigarettes are banned? Will they quit smoking altogether? Will they switch to smoking only regular cigarettes? Will they switch to flavored e-cigarettes? Will they smoke menthol replacements, as described by Michael? Or will they smoke contraband menthol cigarettes? Should these become available. So please respond to these questions, and then we are going to go straight to addressing questions that have come up already and comments that you've made or further that you will make. We have about 10 minutes to still do that. And as you are responding to this, I need to press skip to results, and we'll see the bars moving, and maybe we have, no, we'll give it another minute perhaps. Okay. So it looks like the vast majority of people it's moving around a little bit. Bump, ba-dum, bum. 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay. Let's read it. Almost 60% think that menthol smokers are going to smoke menthol replacements. And about 18% think that they will switch to smoking only regular cigarettes. 11% switch to flavored e-cigarettes. About 8% smoke contraband menthol cigarettes, and 5% quit smoking altogether. So this is interesting. We will wait and see. I guess it'll take us about a year to be able to give you the actual results of this, but we look forward to learning how accurate your predictions have been, and maybe at that time we can have another webinar and report on it. So I think this is a good time then to move to the questions in general, and Shailen will coordinate that one.
Thanks very much, Rob. We do have a few questions. First, I guess since we're talking about menthol, I'll start there. Michael, you were speaking about this, but do you happen to know if these green flavors still taste minty, but perhaps are made using some synthetic or other flavor?
Well, they shouldn't taste minty. So the idea here is still that the menthol ban in cigarettes is follows on the heels of flavor bans in cigarettes in general. So we still have, the flavor bans are coming in Ontario and being considered by Health Canada, are extensions of flavor bans that have already applied to cigarettes, already should have applied, and menthol has been an exception to that. So they shouldn't taste minty. There shouldn't be flavors. The question is there something else that is being done that is that will provide that experience or that sensation that is provided by menthol without actually having a flavor to it? And that's I'd be very curious to know the answer to that. There was a comment I'll just address about capsule products and other creative ways to go around the legislation. And that is another possibility, too. Recently, there have been the implementation in cigarette markets of capsule flavors for menthol, which are little capsules that get squeezed to impart the flavor rather than having them embedded in the packs themselves. And that's something we're certainly going to be monitoring to see what will happen. And there may be even other types of products that you could add on secondarily that wouldn't be sold with the cigarettes themselves to provide either the menthol sensation, which does not have to be mixed in with the tobacco at all, or potentially other flavors as well.
Along that line, thanks very much, Michael, do we happen to know whether contraband manufacturers can produce menthol products?
I don't think they'll have any problem. I don't think it's a terribly complicated process. So where there's a market, I think highly likely that they'll figure it out. In the NIH Menthol Study, the National Institutes of Health in the United States.
Thanks very much. we do have, thanks very much, everybody, for your questions related to menthol. Please feel free to keep them coming. We do have about 6 minutes left to answer some of your questions, but I will go back to some of the questions related to outdoor space. There were some clarifying questions related to the questions that were asked. One question is for you, Michael. Was near defined when you were asking for support for smoke-free spaces?
No. This is part of a larger survey, and so there were a number of different questions. So the wording of the questions themselves was included on the slides, so that near wasn't defined. So again, it was probably a broader definition than in the new measures themselves, but maybe more consistent with the results that Jolene presented in terms of smokers and non-smokers self-described exposure on these areas. This is what people consider to be these areas rather than what necessarily these areas were defined to be. And that's, I think, an issue that has been raised, that those definitions aren't quite matching.
Thanks very much. Another question related to, I guess, definitions. Were there any definitions or advisories related to e-cigarettes in the questions?
There was no. We asked, there were questions that we asked about relative risk perceptions of e-cigarettes versus cigarettes and versus a number of other different products, but we didn't exert a judgment on those within the questions themselves.
Did you ask any questions about support for smoke-free policies on post-secondary campuses by chance?
No, it's a good point, but we didn't ask about that question.
Okay, thanks very much, Michael. We do have one more comment and question. Again, we do have a few more minutes. Feel free to type in any of your questions or comments. There is some assumption that attitudes in favor of outdoor bans, of things like outdoor events and festivals, might go up post-implementation versus before. Have any municipalities already shown that this is the case with smoke-free events and parks?
Right. So I don't think we have the answer to whether the attitudes will change post-ban. Remember, part of the problem here is that there isn't huge awareness about these bans apart from the one on patios. And so I think that we will have to wait and see. I don't know if we have any information about any of the health units or the municipalities already knowing if that is the case.
There was some, you probably saw in the chat box, some conversation about different outdoor space and that are covered or not covered related to smoke-free secondhand smoke exposure. So there's a lot of conversation happening. I think that the folks on the line can feel free to talk to PCCC or others related to where we can go next with smoke-free policies, either at the local level or beyond. We do have a question here related to shisha. What is the situation related to the flavor ban? There's a comment that in Quebec they're still quite active.
I don't believe that we know right now what is happening with flavored shisha in hookup parlors. We're hoping that these are not going to be around for much longer. Several cities have already moved to get rid of them, but I think that's a good question. Part of the issue with shisha is that it's not necessarily known if it is tobacco shisha or not tobacco shisha. And one of the stipulations, the new stipulations that has been instituted, is that enforcement officers now are able to take shisha and have it tested to see whether it is tobacco. I don't think the team here has yet seen any information about that, but it will be interesting to see what we're finding.
Perfect. I'd like to thank everybody for coming on to the webinar today. Thank you to Michael and Rob and Jolene for all of your insights. Following this webinar, everybody on the line, you will be sent an email that will contain a link to an evaluation survey. If everyone could kindly take a few minutes to complete the evaluation, it would be greatly appreciated. Your input will help us improve and host future learning opportunities that meet your needs. Thanks everyone for attending, and thanks to our presenters. Have a great rest of your day.